It's from the Left Forum 2018. The conference was held in New York City in June at John Jay College. The theme, towards a new strategy for the left. In this program, speakers from the panel Covert Action, Persistent U.S. Attacks Against Democracy and Freedom, Past and Present. It was presented by the Covert Action Quarterly. In this program, we'll hear Chris Agee, yes, the son of Philip Agee, one of Covert Action's founders, Lou Wolf, and author, historian, and U.S. foreign policy critic, William Blum. We begin with Professor Chris Agee, involved in the relaunch this year of Covert Action.
I'll just briefly say, you know, what Covert Action means to me. I grew up with this stuff. You know, my dad was in the office in the apartment, and he was always working, and I was always wondering what he was doing. But as I came home from, like, my high school classes, where they were teaching us about this bipolar world, you know, between, my father was saying, there's a little bit more to it than that, right? So he was like, here, check out this book, read this book. And it was the, you know, People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. So just read that, you know, like that. He said, look, some people in the world, you know, this is how the world is, and this is the way the world should be, and some people in the world are trying to reduce that gap. He just kind of summed it up like that. But also, again, I began to look, you know, I would listen to his speeches, you know, I would always go to events and stuff like that, and I found out the terrible stuff that the United States government is doing. And then I would share that with my friends. And by the way, at various times I lived in Virginia, where all my friends, because my mother had set up the house in, you know, right outside of CIA, and so all my friends in the Virginia area were, you know, children of CIA. So I would tell them about what the CIA is really doing, and then all of a sudden get in big trouble with all the people in the neighborhood. Yeah. So I've been trying to educate around this as my father and all of these distinguished panelists too.
Lou Wolf is up next. He's one of the remaining founders of Covert Action, along with Ellen Ray, Bill Shapp, Michael Ratner, Bill Kunstler, and Philip Agee. It began publishing back in 1978, but as you'll hear, Wolf started outing atrocities committed by the U.S. before then. Wolf said it never ceases to amaze him when he studies these issues and studies the CIA and its allied agencies, what they'll stoop to, what they conceive of, and what they'll raise as their objectives and as their priorities. Lou Wolf.
There are very real reasons to start this magazine, restart the magazine, relaunch it today. I'm going to discuss some of them. First of all, let's be very clear that the CIA does not act alone. It's not what they call a rogue agency. It is a very much a central, not just in its name, but a central part of the national intelligence apparatus. There are no less than 17 other intelligence agencies. It's very serious and very deadly. The CIA, for many years, was made out as an analysis agency that analyzes foreign policy. Well, the real truth is the dirty and the real important part of the CIA is the Deputy Directorate of Operations, DDO, as it's called. It's now called the National Clandestine Service. They've fancied up the name a little bit. And we know in the last month, we now have a new Director of Central Intelligence, a woman by the name of Gina Haspel. Now, she went up on Congress and testified that I stand on the greatness of many women before me. I mean, she was making herself out as a feminist. And all these women in the CIA, they are my heroes, and a number of them paid with their lives. Their stars are on the wall at the CIA, where almost all of the stars on that wall are anonymous, no names listed. I had not ever heard before that there were women whose stars are on that wall. It may be true. I don't say it's not true, but there is some question. So this woman had a name inside the CIA, which John Kiriakou, if you look at our website, said we called her Bloody Gina inside the CIA. That was not a nickname. That was based on the fact that she enjoyed torture. She was directly involved in a so-called black site, a very racist term, no question, in Thailand. where one of their inhabitants, or I should say prisoners, was waterboarded 83 times. Just think about that. Where you believe you're drowning, where they put a towel over your face, they hold you down, all four limbs, and you're being drowned for 83 times. But there were all kinds of torture that she was involved with as well. The whole range of tortures, which we know about, sleep deprivation, held in very stress positions with your arms and legs stretched behind you, the parrot's beak where they hold you like this, hanging from a pole. They strapped your body to a chain and whip you back and forth against stone walls, you name it. Also, they used dogs and insects. They had two psychologists come in on board and to ascertain each of the phobias of these all men and what kind of insect. What do you think of insects? And so they introduced scorpions, and they introduced other insects into these boxes that they had. I shouldn't say in the past tense, it's still going on today, as we speak today. Now, CIA has engaged in torture over decades, and they do it. We're not the only ones. We train other agencies around the world. It was GINA in Chile. It was KCIA in Korea. The whole range of agencies which the CIA created. That's what we do. That's what the CIA does, is set up agencies, proxy agencies that carry out the CIA's bidding in all these countries, the purpose of which is to keep hold over the resources of that country, whether it's oil, whether it's minerals, whether it's water. We're now seeing the privatization of water in a number of countries under direction of the U.S. So intelligence is much more than gathering information. It is destroying governments, overthrowing governments, throwing elections, buying use of media, and I hope Bill will follow up with more on this because he has chronicled these activities in country after country after country. All you need to do is look at his website and find that list of dozens and dozens of countries who have faced the wrath of the CIA. You know, I had a dear friend of mine who, when I was in Laos, by the way, I should tell you, is used to be known as the land of 1 million elephants. And it happens today I'm wearing a silk shirt made in Laos, because I go back to Laos because of the fact that this people are still dying from unexploded ordnance. They're called UXOs, bombs that still go off and maim and kill people. Today, long after the war officially ended. So in Laos, I was there helping to build a water sealed latrines and wells and one school. And suddenly I got word that this village where I had been working with this young Lao comrade and friend of mine had been bombed. I urgently went there, drove a jeep over the rice paddies. There are no roads in Laos at that time. Now there are some roads. So you had to drive over the rice paddy. I finally got to the village, and he had told me 2 weeks before that, if they ever bomb our village, that's where we'll go. That was the jungle outside of the village. The population of that village, perhaps 200 people, there were bodies scattered everywhere. There was no single structure left standing. So I went straight to the jungle where he had pointed to me, and I found him there. He was one of about 7 people still surviving at that point. And I took him in my arms, and he was bleeding to death through his ears. It was horrible. And I still recall saying, I will try and find out who bombed your village. Of course, at that time, in 1966, I didn't really know there was such an agency as the CIA. But right then, I started learning, seeing all these guys in plaid in their CIA uniforms, which are khaki pants and plaid shirts, you know, like folks are wearing today. And you knew them right away. I mean, it was like they had a sign on there, you know, we're CIA. So then, moving on to the fact that when I ended up in the Philippines, so I ended up outside Clark Air Force Base, which we started a newspaper called The Whig, named after the Whig Party, which was the left-wing alternative to what became the Republican Party. It wasn't a socialist or a revolutionary party, but it was, in those times, in that context, quite a different party than we know of us today as the Republicans. And we wrote this paper called The Whig, and we outed, among other things, a death squad on Clark Air Force Base, run by the Air Force Police, OSI, Office of Special Intelligence. And they used to take Filipino workers at the base who were very militant. They had a union. They were defending their rights as members of the human race. It wasn't only about salaries, but it was about their rights working under very rough conditions for the U.S. for the Air Force. Very few people who worked for the Air Force in those days were able to own a house or have a living wage. So they used to take the workers up in these watchtowers and push them out to their death. And so we found out what this group was called. They were members of the some of them were Klan members and neo-Nazis. And they called themselves the Red Patches. In fact, they used to wear a patch on their shirts. And it had, if you look on your dollar bill, you have the famous all-seeing eye, which is a very cult symbol. So I knew who the seamstress was making these patches. So I went to her office and said, I came in and she said, did you order the patches? I said, yes. So I was reading her list upside down, and I recall that one of the names. I said, that's me, John. I don't remember his name. And she said, oh, here are your patches. So we went and published that on the front page of The Whig. The Associated Press journalist, who I knew then, picked it up, and it went all over the world. Death Squad on Clark Air Force Base. Well, some of the people who wrote for us, GIs, many of them worked at the hospital there at Clark Air Force Base, and I'll tell you more about that place because I was a patient there later. And so they decided that this should be investigated, and so my photo was put up on the wall at the OSI entrance to the base, and was persona non grata, blah blah blah. So. But the fact is that I was lucky to get out of there alive, and they did take me in a jeep and on a one-way trip to, I thought it was death at the end of that trip, but they took me to Camp Crame in Manila, and the rest is history. I just want to say, when people talk about the CIA, they have to understand that this is an agency which exists to support not only imperialism, but to support, you know, overthrowing governments, as I've been saying. And that's what they do. The rest of what we're told they do is window dressing. Last I want to say is that the work that we're starting now is to counter what we know of as American exceptionalism. Every president in our lifetimes, if you think back, and all of you here in the room, has said those magic words, this is the greatest nation on the face of the earth. Hello? There are 196 other countries, maybe more by now, the latest count. So I guess they're sliced cheese. And Obama said this again and again. He said, we are exceptional. So I'm sorry, exceptionalism has no place. And that's what we have started this, relaunched this magazine to fight American exceptionalism and imperialism. Thank you.
Lou Wolf with Covert Action, and you're listening to Notes from the Left Forum 2018, a panel entitled Covert Action, Persistent U.S. Attacks Against Democracy and Freedom, Past and Present. Next up is William Blum, historian and U.S. foreign policy critic, publisher of the Anti-Empire Report, and author most recently of America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. William Blum.
What do you think is the main barrier to changing the minds of Americans about U.S. foreign policy? Each of you, I'm sure, has met many people who support our foreign policy, with whom you've argued, and you cite example after example, from Iraq to Libya to Vietnam, and you speak of the bombings and the invasions and the torture. And nothing helps. Nothing changes the minds of these people. Now, why is this? Are they simply lacking a social conscience? Or are they just stupid? What is it that holds them back from seeing what we see? I think the answer to that question is that consciously or unconsciously, these people proceed from certain basic assumptions. And then if you don't change those basic assumptions, it's like talking to a stone wall. The most basic of these basic beliefs is, I think, a deeply held conviction that no matter what the U.S. does abroad, no matter how bad it may look, no matter what horror may result, the U.S. government means well. American leaders may make mistakes, they may blunder, they may lie. On occasion, they will certainly do more harm than good, but they do mean well. Their intentions are always honorable, even noble. Of that, the greater majority of the American public is convinced. Frances Fitzgerald, in her famous study of American school textbooks, summarized the message of these books. Quote, "The United States has been a kind of salvation army to the rest of the world. Throughout history, it has done little but dispense benefits to poor, ignorant, and diseased countries. The U.S. always acted in a disinterested fashion, always from the highest of motives. It gave, never took. And Americans genuinely wonder why the rest of the world can't see that. Why can't they see how self-sacrificing we have been? And they remind me, the American public reminds me of Charlie Brown falling for Lucy's football ploy again and again, and they never learn. Many of the citizens are like the children of a mafia boss who don't know what their father does for a living and don't really want to know. Then they have to wonder why someone just threw a smoke bomb through the living room windows. Their basic belief in Americans' good intentions is often linked to American exceptionalism. let's look at just how exceptional America has been. I've spent decades and decades summarizing these things. Since the end of World War II, the United States has, one, attempted to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments, most of whom which had been democratically elected. Two, dropped bombs on the people of more than 30 countries. Three, attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders. Four, attempted to suppress a populist or nationalist movement in 20 countries. Five, grossly interfered in democratic elections in at least 30 countries. And six, led the world in torture. Not just the torture performed directly upon foreigners by Americans, but providing torture equipment, torture manuals, lists of people to be tortured, and in-person guidance by American teachers, especially in Latin America. This is indeed exceptional. No other country in all of history or anywhere in the world comes anywhere close to this record, but it certainly makes it difficult to believe that America means well. So the next time you're up against one of these Americans whose mind is closed against this, whose mind is like a stone wall, ask the person what the U.S. would have to do in their foreign policy to make them change their mind. What for them would finally be too much? Most likely, or whatever it is this person might suggest, the U.S. has already done. Keep in mind that our precious homeland, above all, seeks to dominate the world for economic reasons, nationalistic reasons, ideological, Christian, and for other reasons. World hegemony has long been America's bottom line. And let's not forget the powerful executive and branch and the military, whose salaries and promotions and whose agencies' budgets and future well-paying private employment, all of which depends upon perpetual wars. One war after another assures them of this rosy future. These leaders are not especially concerned about the consequences of what they do. They're not necessarily bad people, but they are amoral, just like a sociopath is. Take the Middle East and South Asia. The people in those areas have suffered horribly because of Islamic fundamentalism. What they desperately need are secular governments which have respect for other religions. And such governments were actually instituted in the recent past. But what was the fate of these governments? Well, in the late 1970s through much of the 1980s, Afghanistan had a secular government that was relatively progressive, with full rights for women. That's hard to believe, isn't it? But even a Pentagon report of that period has certified that this was the case. They even praised them for what they were doing. And what happened to that government? Well, the U.S. overthrew it, of course, allowing the Taliban to come to power. So the next time you hear that we have to remain in Afghanistan for the sake of the women, keep in mind what I'm saying. After Afghanistan came Iraq, another secular society under Saddam Hussein. And the U.S. overthrew that government as well. And now the government has its share of crazed jihadists, and women have to be very careful of how they dress to avoid becoming victims of these jihadists. Next came Libya, again a secularist society under Muammar Gaddafi, who, like Saddam Hussein, had a tyrant in him, but could in important ways do some marvelous things. Like he founded the African Union, and under him, Libya had the highest standard of living in all of Africa. So of course, the U.S. overthrew him as well. In 2011, with the help of NATO, we bombed the people of Libya almost every day for more than 6 months, which is seldom mentioned these days in the news. Whenever you hear about the U.S. overthrowing North Korea using the Libyan model, we never reminded much at all about the U.S. bombing, which was horrific for 6 months. So what is the leader of North Korea to think about this when he reads and he mentions that you've warned us about being part of the Libyan model? Can anyone say in any of these interventions or in any of them that the United States means well? When we attack Iran in the future, will we mean well? Will we have the welfare of the Iranian people at heart? I suggest you keep such thoughts in mind the next time you're having a discussion or argument with one of the flag-waving, stone-closed minds of Americans. Keep in mind what I've said to attempt, at least, to enlighten them. Thank you very much.
Author, historian, foreign policy critic William Blum with the Anti-Empire Report. And you've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum, a conference at John Jay College in June 2018. This program was from the panel Covert Action, Persistent U.S. Attacks Against Democracy and Freedom, Past and Present. You heard William Blum, Lou Wolf, and Chris Agee. The program was produced by Richard Barr and Linda Perry for Pacifica Radio and WBAI New York. Thanks to the Left Forum, and thank you for listening.